FEKFE Ferric 90 tape. Low noise, high output. Probably gives distorted signals. I don't know. We must wait and see. It seems to work reasonably well. Before I go any further, I must introduce myself and tell the listener how I come into the picture relating to Kurt Hahn. My name is Captain Maurice Seddon, S-E-D-D-O-N. I'm just an old wreck with all kinds of medical problems, of 79, approaching 80 years of age. Today's date, if I'm correct, is the Saturday, the 19th of November, 2005. My name is spelt S for sugar, E-D-D-O-N. Because of my partly French origins, the Christian name is Maurice, M-A-U-R-I-C-E. I'm stopping now to test the recording. So far, so good. My address is Datchet, D for dog, A-T-C-H-E-T, Datchet.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength with me, William English, on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net, which for the next 4 weeks is being broadcast from the Science Museum through an exponential horn. Today's guest is Walter Heyman, a professor of pure mathematics at Imperial College London. For over 30 years, Walter Heyman ran a school of renown in complex analysis, attracting mathematicians from all over the world. At this point, I should say that I failed maths at O-level, which raises the question, why have I got Professor Heyman on my program? Well, on March the 24th of this year, Captain Maurice Seddon, Royal Signals retired, was cremated at Slough. As executor of Maurice's will, I had to contact all the beneficiaries of his will, one of whom is Professor Heyman. And it was at the funeral that I met Walter for the first time, and I learned that Maurice and Walter had both attended Gordonston School, and perhaps that's where we can start. So, good afternoon, Walter. Thank you very much for coming on the programme.
Well, perhaps I could start by saying something about Gordonston School. Kurt Hahn is a cousin of my mother's, or was a cousin of my mother's, and he was secretary to Prince Max von Baden and had quite a lot of political influence on the Versailles Treaty and other things. But later on, encouraged by Prince Max, he founded Salem School in South Germany. And this was quite a successful school, attended by Prince Philip, among other persons. And when, in 1932, three Nazis trampled a communist to death, Hitler sent them a telegram of congratulations. And Hahn called a school meeting and said, you couldn't be a Nazi and a Salem boy. And this didn't go down very well with Hitler, so Hahn was imprisoned when Hitler came to power next year. But as a result of his international friends, he was released and founded Gordonston School in 1934, where Prince Philip and other Salem boys followed him.
This was in Scotland, of course. Yeah?
This was in Scotland, near Elgin Marischshire, where the school is still flourishing, and various members of the royal family, including Prince Charles, went to it.
Yeah.
I came in 1937 for a year, a preliminary visit of 6 weeks, and then in 1938 I came to West Elk as the prep school for Gordonston, and in 39 I came up to the main school. And a year later, the main school was evacuated to Wales. I'm very much indebted to Kurt Hahn, my mother's cousin, who enabled me to live there free and be educated, and he and two other cousins paid for my education there. Mm. The school was very good for me personally because it encouraged all the things I was bad at, such as outdoor sports, activity of various sorts, and so on. I would have been a complete couch potato probably if I hadn't gone to Gordonston. As it is, I still do 6 press-ups a day. I still have cold showers after my hot shower, and so I'm in reasonably good health for somebody of 88.
Yeah. You were born the same year as Morris, I think, 1926.
I was born the same year as Morris, 7, and we were together in Gordonston School, and we became friends and came together through the Gordonston dinners, which take place in March every year. Sadly, Morris died, but I visited him once in hospital when he was already rather frail. Mm.
So your main point of contact would have been at the Gordonston dinners?
That was my main point of contact with Morris.
Right. And so did you go to school in Wales as well?
The school was evacuated in 1940 to Wales because we were too near Lossiemouth Aerodrome, and the government wasn't keen on having a German-speaking headmaster so near, and there were quite a lot of German refugee children in the school. Mm. So we had to go, and this could have been a disaster. But Kurt Hahn, who was always very clever at inventing things and getting people to support them, found a method by which 2 years spent on the Conway training ship were equivalent. 2 years spent at Gordonston were equivalent to 1 year on the Sale training ship. Mm-hmm. So we got a number of these Conway boys, and that helped the school survive this period, because of course a lot of the Scottish Gordonston boys didn't follow us to Wales. So we survived that way. I fortunately managed to survive without actually going on a sail, which most Gordonston boys had to, because my parents received a letter saying would they indemnify the school for any accident or death that might occur to me, and I told my parents don't sign. So as a result of that, I didn't have to go on a sail. I couldn't avoid all activities. For instance, I got an early version of the what is now called the Duke of Edinburgh Award, and was then called the County Badge, first the Murray Badge, and then the Montgomery Badge. Hmm. So I'm very grateful to the school, and particularly to Kurt Hahn, for all they did for me, setting me on my way.
I suppose a bit like Morris, you were quite lucky to get a place there in a way. But weren't most people sort of fee-paying students? Wasn't it quite an expensive school?
It wasn't perhaps as expensive then as it is now.
Right.
But it was quite expensive. But my cousin and his two cousins paid my fees.
Right.
So that was that's the way I survived, because my parents had no money.
And where were your parents at this point?
Well, they were still in Cologne. But they managed to get out in April 1939.
Hmm. Right.
So my immediate family, my sister, went to Italy, and she survived because the Italians weren't basically anti-Semitic, but when the Germans took over, she was in danger. So she went on in a convent on condition that she could go for a walk with her fiancé every afternoon. So that is how she survived. And it turned out that she was married 4 years to the day before I was married. Quite a curious coincidence.
Right. Mm. So what did you do after Gordonston?
Well, my uncle had asked me what I wanted to be when I was still at Scrap School. And I said, I want to be a professor of mathematics. And he said, what an ambition. It didn't seem to me to be an odd ambition. My father was a professor of law, my grandfather was a professor of mathematics, so it seemed a very natural thing for me to want to be a mathematician, and that is what I became.
Right.
As a result of the school supporting me for 3 weeks in Cambridge, I managed to get a major scholarship to St. John's College, Cambridge, and I did my undergraduate work in 2 years and then started research. And in 1947, I took my first job as a lecturer at Newcastle, which was then University College Newcastle, part of the University of Durham. Mm-hmm. And a little later that year, I went to Exeter, got married to my wife, Margaret, whom I met as a student in Cambridge. And then I went to Exeter for 9 years. And from there, I went in 1956 as the first professor of pure mathematics at Imperial College.
Mm. And you've been at Imperial College ever since 1956?
Yes, except with a break in York. My wife was born in York, and we were married in York, and so she wanted to go back there. Mm. So I managed to get York to give me a part-time professorship after retiring from Imperial College.
Right.
It is unfortunately a case in this degenerate age that the only way to make one's institution really happy is to retire. So I feel one should do that as often as possible. So I've retired twice so far.
Right. Can you tell me, I mean, as somebody, as I said earlier, I failed O-level maths. Perhaps you could tell me a bit about what pure mathematics is. I mean, I have no idea really about the world of pure mathematics.
Well, it isn't very easy to explain, but in a way it is like playing chess. Mm-hmm. I mean, you try to do it as well as possible. It does occasionally have applications, and then it's called applied mathematics.
Right.
But pure mathematics basically doesn't have many applications, but it is useful in all sorts of subjects like electronics, electrical engineering, physics, and so on. It does come in, and it's taught to many undergraduates.
But you yourself have limited yourself to non-applied mathematics, basically.
No, my mathematics is not applicable in the main, at least not the sort of stuff that I do, but it is called function theory and complex analysis, and it really got a lift in the 19th century with the work of Cauchy and Riemann.
Oh, yes.
And since then, it has been a very flourishing and important subject.
Right. You were telling me about Riemann earlier. Is he the one that posed this problem which hasn't yet been solved?
Well, the Riemann hypothesis has been open for getting on for certainly over 150 years now.
Hmm.
And, whoever solves it will be very famous, but it shows no sign of being solved or getting anywhere near it.
Right. Can you give me a brief idea of what such a problem is?
Well, I am interested in functions of complex variables. Complex numbers are two-dimensional numbers, and these functions, analytic functions, are convergent power series of such a number. Well, one such function is the Riemann-Zeta function, which plays an important role in number theory. Mm. And the hypothesis is that the only places where this function is zero are on the line, on a certain line, where and on this, although there are a lot of zeros on this line, it isn't known whether they are all on the line. And although it's known that all the ones up to a certain very large number are.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the hypothesis, that they should be all on the line, and that would be interesting applications to the theory of prime numbers, which is number theory.
Yes, and you were telling me also about the prime numbers, how there are some numbers which are only two numbers apart, but they could you expand on that a little
bit? Well, prime numbers are numbers which are not divisible by any other number.
Right.
The only even prime number is 2, and all the other prime numbers are odd and not divisible by 2, of course.
Right.
And they can't also be divisible by 3, so you can't have 3 of them in sequence of twos, but you can have 2. So, for instance, 5 and 7 are prime, 11 and 13 are prime, 29 and 31 are prime, and so on. And it is not known whether there are an infinite number of such pairs.
Right.
And it is conjectured that there are.
Mm-hmm.
But this conjecture is far from being proved. But very recently, somebody had an outstanding result that there are pairs of prime numbers whose difference is less than about 32 million.
Right.
and this was a tremendous achievement.
Yeah.
And the 32 million has since been reduced to about a few hundreds, I believe. But
right.
That's a long way from two.
Yes. Is this the area of mathematics which you are involved in?
No, I'm not. I'm in complex analysis, which is functions of complex numbers. Mm-hmm. This is a number theory.
Right.
My grandfather was a number theorist. He would have appreciated the importance of the Riemann hypothesis and the twin primes that I've talked about.
Right, okay. But your grandfather, I think his theory had sort of what one might call ramifications. It spawned other theories and ideas which became applied? Or?
Well, they are certainly used in various ways. My grandfather invented periodic numbers. Periodic numbers are power series in some prime P, like if P is 3, for instance, they would be not 1 or 2 3s, so many 3 squared, 3 cubed, and so on. And
right.
This is a series which goes on forever, and that's a three-adic number.
Right.
Well, he invented these things, and periodic numbers have played a very major role in all sorts of mathematical concepts, algebra and geometry, and so on.
Right.
So that theory of his has become extremely fruitful since then.
And your own research, you've published several books. What is your specific area of interest?
Well, my area of mathematics is called function theory or theory of functions.
Hmm.
And I have written books on subharmonic functions, multivalent functions, meromorphic functions, and research problems in function theory.
Right.
So the word function occurs frequently, and consequently I've called my autobiography, My Life and Functions.
Right, which is quite misleading in a way because it suggests that there is some use or application in a way. The word function seems to sort of invoke the idea that it can actually be applied in some way, but that's not the case in your...
Well, a function in mathematics means that it is one number depending on another number. So it's a function of that number.
Okay.
For instance, x squared is a function. It's right. A square. X is a number, and x squared is another number.
That's right.
And yeah. X squared is the function involved.
Okay. And subharmonics, is that sounds, again, to me, that sounded like something that was to do with sound, but apparently not.
Well, it could have been. I mean, harmonic functions are functions which obey a certain equation, and that equation, Laplace's equation, is related to sound. But it isn't very close to applications either.
Okay.
But I did have some friends who played in what they called a subharmonic quartet,
oh, really?
Which they hoped they would up it to an harmonic quartet eventually.
So was that just a joke name for it, or was
that
it?
That was a joke because we were all function theorists, and of course they knew about subharmonic functions.
Yeah, yeah. And I think you're related to Mendelssohn in some way. Aren't
yes,
you?
My grandfather's grandmother, Kurtenzel's grandmother, was Fanny Mendelssohn, the sister of Felix.
Okay.
And so we are quite proud of being related to music in that way.
Right, yeah. And you play the piano
I play the piano. I prefer to accompany other people because then I can hide behind them when I make mistakes.
Well, we might ask you to sort of sing later. I think you have a song, one of your wife's songs, but perhaps we could sing it. You might sing it later and we can hear how it comes out through the exponential horn.
Well, I can sing it now.
Oh, okay. Sure.
And she composed words to a Chopin prelude.
Ah.
The tune is a Chopin prelude.
Right.
And when you came to me and gave me all your love, you set my spirit free, and grace came from above to decorate each day with precious memories. And in these golden years, I found my perfect peace.
Very good. Okay.
I would not have made a living as a singer.
I don't know. We have a small audience here. We could have. I didn't notice any applause, but. So, okay, well, we might play some Chopin and theremin music later, not yet. But that song was, the words are by your wife.
Yes.
For Marie, who yes. I think is your third wife.
That's right. Unfortunately, my first two wives died on me. Right. But at least I had 47 years with Margaret. We have three daughters and six grandchildren, of whom one is a grandson. Uh-huh. And I now have one great-grandson as well.
The question, I mean, I sort of, I read through the first draft of your autobiography, and I was struck by the sort of course of the, shall we say, you're of a Jewish background, but I think your family converted to Protestantism.
Yes, that's right.
And then
my mother's family, from Mendelssohn's onward, converted in about 1815 or so. My father converted as a young man.
Right. And then you yourself became a Quaker, I think.
I joined Friends, the Society of Friends, otherwise known as Quakers, when I was a student.
Right.
Because there was a boy at school called Michael Hinton who was very, whom I admired. And so I wanted to find out about Quakers. And Charles Carter was in the same corridor of my college, and he was a friend. He later became Vice Chancellor of Manchester, of Lancaster.
Right.
And he befriended me very much in various ways. We both got married soon afterwards, and he showed me how to take my wife on my knee and introduced me to the finer points of marriage in this way.
Okay. Right.
And but he also took me to Friends meeting in Jesus Lane, Cambridge. And I've been a Quaker ever since.
But you were a Quaker or perhaps still are a Quaker, have been for many years. But then I think when you married your latest wife, you converted to become a Shia Muslim.
Well, I didn't convert. I became a Shia Muslim as well as a Quaker. Quakers are very forgiving. And I went to Friends meeting all the time I was a Muslim. But it was a very curious marriage I had with Wafika, because it was all done by advocates in Arabic. And so I had no idea what was being said on my behalf.
Right.
But Wafika told me afterwards that I'd promised all sorts of things, including buying a house where they could both live in.
Yeah.
We could both live in.
Yeah.
We never succeeded in doing that because by then she had all sorts of chemical allergies, so she was always allergic to anything we found. But then I asked her, what did you promise? And she said, oh, I didn't promise anything particular. I had no comeback.
So well, it's quite a curious... what are you now? What would you call yourself now?
Well, I've always been a Quaker.
Okay.
I continue to be a Quaker, and two of my weddings have been in Quaker meeting, the first and the third. It's only the second one, which is in a which was in a mosque.
Right. So you are obviously a believer of some sort.
Well, belief is a matter. I am not sure that I believe anything particular.
Right.
But Friends, it's more what they do. We go to meeting on Sunday mornings, and we try to live a good life, and various other things.
Yeah.
But I don't think that there's anything which you could say that Quakers invariably believe in. Most of us do believe in the fact that there is that of God in everyone, and we try to bring it out in the person we converse with.
Right. Okay.
And a lot of them are pacifists, but I personally am not. And when I joined in Cambridge in As a student, I didn't say I was a pacifist. I said I wasn't, and because of Hitler, and I don't think that he could have been stopped except by war.
Right.
And so I felt that on this occasion, the Second World War was justified.
Yeah. I wonder how your a life in mathematics does that. How does that square with religion?
Not particularly.
No.
I don't think they're particularly related.
They're not related, but does it not present problems? Mathematics being entirely to do with logic.
I try to be a good person, and as well as doing mathematics, I've had various students and tried to befriend them.
Yeah.
And I don't think that one's profession is particularly related to your religion, unless you're a clergyman or something like that.
No, okay. And you were saying earlier that this sort of passion you have for pure mathematics, it is almost like it's almost like poetry at times, isn't it?
Yes, I think mathematics is a bit like poetry or like an art. The sort of mathematics I do seems to me to be more closely related to art than to science in many ways.
Oh, that's interesting.
And certainly the subjects at school which I like best apart from mathematics were English and languages, rather than physics, chemistry and biology.
Yeah.
So although I'm supposed to be a scientist, and I was at my election in 1956 the youngest fellow of the Royal Society for 3 years, in spite of that, I feel I'm in some ways not a very typical scientist, because being a pure mathematician, I'm not very much related to other scientific people.
Right, but your branch of mathematics is almost is totally abstract, isn't it? It's kind of it has no. You prefer to focus on mathematics, which has no application whatsoever.
Well, I don't prefer. It's just that I prefer that kind of mathematics, and it's a very particular and special thing. Not a very large area, but we do have people who study it in all parts of the globe, and we come together in international conferences from time to time.
Right.
But there are not an awful lot of us. Mathematics is very split into many different branches, and mathematicians have to learn to listen to lectures of which they don't understand a word from each other.
Yes, you showed me in Imperial College. You showed me the what do you call it, the staff, of which there seem to be dozens and dozens of people, and apparently you almost can't communicate with each other because you've all got this very specific.
Well, we all have different disciplines, but we can talk about other things.
Yeah.
I think a mathematician has to develop other subjects of conversation, because he certainly can't talk about mathematics to most other people.
Could you describe you devised this problem to do with a chessboard, I think?
Well, I gave as an example. People always ask me, how can you prove that something isn't possible? And so when I gave my inaugural lecture, I gave this example of something, a proof that something is impossible. Consider a chess board, 8x8 squares, black and white. And the question is, supposing you take up the two opposite corners of the chess board, can you then cover it by rectangles of 1x2? So that the whole board is covered by these 31 rectangles of 1x2.
Right.
And the answer is no, you can't. Because a rectangle of 1x2 will always cover one black square and one white square, because they're adjacent to each other.
Yeah.
But if you remove the opposite corners, they have the same color. So you have a different number of white squares from the number of black squares, either more or less.
Okay.
And so you can't cover what's left exactly by 31 1x2 squares. So that's an example of a proof that something can't be done.
Right. And is that sort of, proving things that can't be done, is that a sort of, is that a line of inquiry that you...
Well, I think that's true in all mathematics. You ask, is this true or is it false? And you try to prove that it's true by a theorem, or you can prove it's false by a counterexample.
Yeah.
So we always try to give examples that something can or can't be done.
Right, okay. Which brings me on to, I think I was telling you about my friend who I had invited to come here to talk about perpetual motion, talking about things which can't be done. And I asked somebody from the Science Museum to meet with him, and I think they were quite sort of scornful of the whole idea of perpetual motion. And my friend was kind of concerned that if he came and talked about perpetual motion, that he would be laughed at. So neither of them are going to turn up. And I wondered if you, did you have any thoughts about, perpetual motion sounds like one of those things that is impossible.
Well, in any kind of motion, energy is involved. Energy is used either by friction or in other ways to produce this motion. So energy is used, but if there's no input of energy into this machine, then it can't go on forever.
Right.
It will run down.
Yeah.
And so perpetual motion is an impossibility.
Yeah. So that is the received sort of... But there are people that persist with trying to solve this problem.
Well, there are always people who have wrong ideas.
Okay. So how often did you... To return to Morris briefly, I mean, it sounds like you didn't... He must have had a high regard for you, because he mentions you in the will, but... You had very little contact with him.
Well, I didn't see that much of him, but we did meet at the Gordonson dinners, which take place once a year in Fino's near Piccadilly.
Right.
And we used to meet there and talk, and I did visit him in hospital once.
Yeah.
When he was already quite ill.
Yeah.
And after all, we go back a long way because we knew each other at school.
Yeah. We could listen to a little bit more. We could listen to a brief snatch of Morris talking about Kurt Hahn, I think.
That a very large number of refugee Jews from Germany settled in Hampstead and in neighbouring Golders Green. And so we were surrounded by a largely Jewish society, and we had numerous Jewish friends. Now, in due course, I don't know the detail of exactly how it happened. I know one or two details. My mother did have an English friend, a Mrs. Naylor, N-A-Y-L-O-R, and she had a son, John. And he was a pupil at Gordonston, and she had found it a very helpful school, and one into which her son had settled well. She also, being surrounded by Jewish people, probably had contacts which, through the Jewish world, probably led again to Kurt Hahn. I must test the quality of the recording. In the meantime, it's 20 minutes before 8 o'clock in the evening on Wednesday the 19th.
That was just a snatch of Morris's speaking voice. I mean, he was renowned as an inventor. He invented heat. But it seems as though that whole side of him passed you by in a way. He founded something called the Experimental Wireless Club while still at Gordonston. Did you ever see anything of that? Do you remember anything to do with that? And I think his friend was Paul Packard. I don't know if he had anything to do with that, but.
Well, I knew Paul Packard, but I'm afraid I wasn't really concerned with any practical things.
Right.
I'm very impractical now, and I'm totally incomputable.
Right. So you don't use a computer?
I don't use email, and I don't use anything like that. So
really?
Things of this sort would have passed me by. There was another man called Jeremy Fry who was at school, and he was very good on motor bicycles and things like that.
Right.
So although the school had its own ideas about what a boy should be, it encouraged us to make the best of our own talents.
Right.
The school motto is plus est en vous, there's more in you, and they tried to draw out what was in you.
Yeah.
And I think they were very good in producing boys of various talents, and that came out later on. Even some academics like myself. I remember one boy at school, for instance, who was very Welsh. He's called Geraint Griffiths. Now it's spelled in a funny way because it's the Welsh spelling. Mm. And at one stage, I, being keen on languages, said, why don't you come and join us and learn some French? And he said, no, no, I don't want to learn any foreign language except English. And what does he do now? Well, he is famous for his Welsh dictionary and as a member of the British Academy for that.
Okay.
So this is an example of how people often show early in life something which is going to occupy the rest of their life.
Okay. Well, perhaps we should play. I think in your is this autobiography going to be published? Are you your sort of?
Yes, it's going to be sort of semi-published. It's a rather small firm, which a friend of mine, who's a mathematician at Maynooth, in the University of Ireland, has, and he's going to publish it.
Right. And so it'll be sort of like a small, for friends and relatives, possibly.
Yes,
like
it's for friends and relatives, and but it can be bought.
Okay.
I hope it can be bought by somebody who might want to buy it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I thought we'd play a snatch of, since Chopin is a favorite of yours, I think. Is that true?
Well, I'm certainly very, very fond of Chopin, those easier pieces which I can play. Some of them are far too difficult for me.
I thought we'd play. This is a snatch of Chopin on a theremin. I don't know if you're familiar with the theremin, a sort of electronic gadget or musical instrument.
No,
which
I don't
it,
know.
It sounds almost like a science fiction soundtrack.
I thought theremins were something which attracted animals to sexually, but
does anyone in the audience know what that word is? Is it a pheromone or something? Okay, well, let's hear a snatch of this sexually attractive whatever it is. Okay. Thank you. Well, that was from Clara Rockmore's Lost Theremin album. And that was a Chopin piece. Do you recognise that one?
No, I don't think I know that one.
Okay.
No.
What sort of music do you prefer to play?
Well, I do play some Chopin. At the moment, I'm practicing the Enigma variations for four hands, which I have a piano teacher friend who comes on Monday mornings to play for an hour with me. And, I play Mozart sonatas and some of the easier Beethoven sonatas. The more difficult it is, the worse I play. Mm. But when I was at school, my dear English master, Henry Brereton, once suggested the title of an essay, "If a thing's worth doing, it's worth doing badly." And I've always taken that to heart. And I play bad bridge and bad chess, and I even played bad ping pong at one stage.
Okay. So what's the state of mathematics at the moment then? I mean, your pure mathematics research, where does it go these
days?
Well,
it will go on forever.
Right.
Not like perpetual motion, because I don't think the universe is going to last forever. But it certainly seems to me that mathematics is going to continue for a very long time.
Yeah. We have a book of yours here. Research Problems in Function Theory. And it is almost like sort of, it is quite poetic, isn't it? I mean, I can't even read the thing because it's so, the equations are impossible for the layperson to actually comprehend. I mean, could you possibly read some of it out, perhaps?
Well,
live on air, maybe some sort of...
I can certainly read it out. Here is an example of something which I posed at one stage. If fz is non-constant and meromorphic in the plane, and n equals 3 or 4, prove that phi z equals f dash z minus fz to the n assumes all finite complex values. This is known to be true if fz is the integral function or n is greater or equal to 5, if fz is meromorphic. That particular problem has since been solved.
Right. Okay. Did you pose the problem?
I posed the problem. I started doing it for some values of n which are larger, and then the remaining values of n were proved to be the case by
right.
someone else.
Right. Okay. And you were talking earlier about Einstein as well. I mean, that was quite...
Well, yes, there was this question of having ideas. Somebody up to Einstein and he asked him, "Professor Einstein, what do you do when you have an idea? Do you go and write it down immediately in a notebook, or do you think about it for a while?" Einstein said, "Yeah, an idea. That doesn't happen very often."
Right. And so your area of research, see, is it like a chess game? It's like a constant posing of variations on the same sort of problems, which just goes around and round?
Well, it doesn't go round and round, it goes on. Because
right.
once something has been done, it's been done, and then you go on from there.
Right.
So there is a continuation. That's true of all bits of mathematics, not just my particular field. Mine is only one field among many.
But it is it's purely abstract. It's only you and perhaps a handful of other people.
Oh, there are more than a handful.
Who understand your specific issues?
Well, I'm going to go to a conference, and there'll be 40 people at least in an international conference. So I would say there are hundreds of people who understand it from all over the world.
Right.
Perhaps thousands.
Yeah.
But that's only a small proportion of humanity, of course.
Yeah.
I'd just like to give another example of one of my most valued teachers, Littlewood. And he had an 80th birthday, and some very enthusiastic journalist came up to him and he said, "Oh, this is so wonderful to be with you, Professor Littlewood. I've so much admired your work, and I do hope that I'll be able to be with you on your 90th birthday." And Littlewood looked him up and down and he said, "Well, I don't see why not, young man. You look quite healthy to me."
Well, You've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, which is broadcasting from the Science Museum through an exponential horn. And today's guest was Professor Walter Heyman, Professor of Pure Mathematics at Imperial College since 1956. Retired twice, in fact.
Yes. Is that true? I hope to retire a few more times.
And I think you need to get away, don't you? You have to go off to Canada Water or something. Someone's going to collect you, I think.
Yes, that's
so
right.
So perhaps we should wind up our interview at that point. We could continue perhaps with, I don't know, another Clara Rockmore track, perhaps track one, which is a Fritz Kreisler track, which you corrected me. It says on the CD Liebeslied or something, but you think it should be Liebeslied.
I think so, yes.
Yeah, it seems to make more sense. Or is it Liebeslied?
No, Liebeslied definitely not.
No, okay.
But EI and IE can easily be interchanged in some cases.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Walter Heyman, for coming on the program. Thank you.
was called Schloss Salem, or to Americanize it, Schloss Salem. Schloss Salem, Salem, is in the extreme south of Germany, quite close to what is, I believe, the largest inland sea in Europe, which is called in German Bodensee, and which translates into English as Lake Constance. And near that lake is the Schloss Salem, and in Schloss Salem was founded a private internat for education of young men in 1919, which logically enough took the name Schule Schloss Salem, the school in Castle Salem, of which the prince's private secretary was made the headmaster of the school. So he fulfilled from that moment a dual role, and Courthahn was of Jewish extraction. I believe the family came from Berlin. I'm not too sure of that, but I think so. Amongst the pupils of the school were, of course, the son of the house and the sons of friendly neighbouring houses. Naturally enough, Prince Philip, who now is the Duke of Windsor, am I right, Windsor? I'm always so absent-minded on these things. Wait a minute. I beg your pardon. No, I'm talking nonsense. Prince Philip, who is now the Duke of Edinburgh, that's right, in England, I'm forgetting my English words, the husband, the consort of the sovereign, the Queen Elizabeth. All went very well, and the school had a good reputation as a small, rather select establishment, and it ran quite happily until the Nazi gangsters came to power in 1934. I'm again stopping the machine to verify how the recording has gone. Yes, seems satisfactory. I must point out, being impoverished, everything I have and buy and use is very old and second-hand, or fifth-hand, or tenth-hand. And that includes this tape, which therefore is being re-recorded over whatever may happen to be on it from previous times. So the listener is begged to excuse the possibility that there may be little periods when there may be bursts of old irrelevant recording which might possibly break through. Now, the Nazi gangsters, as is well known, were fanatically anti-Semitic, and they had the effrontery to burst into Schloss Salem and to place Courthahn under some form of arrest. It may have been house arrest or may have been something more than that, but certainly some form of arrest. Fortunately for Courthahn, he in his youth had been a scholar in Oxford, where he came to know young Englishmen, including the one who later became the Bishop of York of the Church of England, and I think possibly other bishops as well. And when these people learned in England of the ghastly activities of the Nazis, they approached Ramsay MacDonald, who was then the Prime Minister in England of it was either a Labour or a Liberal government, I'm not sure which it was, and said in effect, you must do something about this. And what was done was very simple. The Nazi government were told in no uncertain terms that if they arrested people of the worldwide fame and reputation of Courthahn, they could only damage the good name of Germany. And the gangsters, not at that stage wanting to fall out just yet with England, said, oh dear, we better let him go. So they let him go, and systematically thereafter, Courthahn prepared for an evacuation to Great Britain, together with a large proportion of the staff of the school and a large proportion of the boys, the pupils of the school, in many cases with their families. And this duly took place, and they arrived in Britain, and they obtained considerable support, first of all from that Bishop of York and others of that kind who had been with Courtin in Oxford, and also from other people who saw the grave injustice that was being done in Germany. And an old, rather decrepit mansion was obtained, or the use of an old mansion was obtained in Murrayshire called Gordonston, and Schule Schloss Sadem was able to unsiedeln, to settle down there under the name Gordonston. And it took boys of many origins, both German and English, and a considerable proportion of Jewish people were involved. So, I've now had three quarters of an hour rest, and it's shortly before 1900 hours on Friday, I beg your pardon, Saturday the 19th of November 05, and I'm ready once more, a little strengthened, to resume. I think at this stage it's important that I have to explain to the listener the how it came about that Courtin and I came together, as we did, to great benefit, and for which I'm very grateful. It's a long and a complicated history, and I'm afraid it's a necessary ingredient of the understanding. My mother was German-French. My father was English. The father was the son of a salt king, who was also the mayor of Middlewich in Cheshire, whose name was Henry Seddon. This was a bearded patriarch, pretty ferocious, and I would have thought pretty dictatorial personality. I didn't have much to do with him. I met him just very occasionally. His son was my father, and I will come back to that later. Now, to explain my mother's background in Germany. My mother's family was closely involved in the entourage of the royal court of what was then the Kingdom of Hanover, which is in North Germany, where her grandfather, königliche Professor, Dommusikdirektor, which translates as royal professor, cathedral music director.